Well, welcome back.
I'm back. I'm here. I'm still here.
That's right. We're doing part two.
Part two of Envision Bashing.
Right. I always feel like I should be doing my best Paul Harvey imitation. You youngsters don't know who Paul Harvey was, but Paul Harvey used to do this radio show for decades and decades and
radio,
decades.
Radio.
Yeah. What?
XM radio.
I made a joke with my students in class today. I said, you know, it's kind of like adjusting when you're doing a parameterization. It's like adjusting with a knob. And I turned and I said, for those of you who know what a knob is. Right. But Paul Harvey, it was like he had a national audience, and it was, what was the name of the program? Anyway, it was like, you know, something with Paul Harvey. And you know, and he would always read from a page, and he'd read the story, you know, in a very definitive radio voice. And then he'd go, page two. And then he would continue like this. And it was actually pretty great. I always want to go.
Was the point, Paul, I am no Paul Harvey, or is it?
That's right, Senator.
I work for Paul Harvey. Yeah.
You're no Paul Harvey. Yeah. So anyway, so speaking of Envision, not so much actually just Envision.
Well, I think we concluded that Envision's fantastic. It's doing exactly what it's supposed to do, and everyone's very happy.
Right. Actually, one thing Quentin Zondervan said last night, which I think was kind of right. Mm-hmm. So yes, there were some specific scenarios that were being laid out. Mm-hmm. That did not go over super well, but he made the point, and he might be right, that if you actually look at some of the goals that were expressed as part of this Envision thing, which there is no report yet, so it's kind of hard to say what it's going to be really, but that some of the goals were actually pretty good captures of today.
Okay.
But the specific recommendations and measures of success or failure may leave a little bit to be desired.
Well, I've been to a few meetings. I've tried to stay away from Envision just because it started in an awful way. I always thought it would end in an awful way. And the three schemes that I've seen relative to, which really isn't what Envision is, these housing schemes were sort of shoehorned in. But the affordable overlay, the super inclusionary, and what they're calling sort of the environmental
Performance bonus,
which only really exists from now until 2025 when it's mandatory, which right. creates a very strange zoning scenario that you could possibly take advantage of the environmental track, and then after 2025, your building is actually non-conforming. So
right.
I think you need to just think about that.
Yeah.
But the super inclusionary and the affordable overlay, they're being presented in such a strange manner where they're like these immensely powerful zoning changes that don't really create a ton of housing.
Right.
And it's almost like, why did you scare the entire city with something that's not going to do much?
Yeah.
And
in many respects, it almost seemed like they were trying to be disruptive. Like, say, let's be the bull in the china shop, go into an established neighborhood and propose just doing something that you know darn well people
are going to be happy. I always wonder, like, what question is being answered?
And for what? For what purpose? Exactly. Yeah. So anyway, that was kind of interesting. But but some of the goals I think are reasonably laudable. I think it's okay. It's fine. But you know what I thought was how this whole thing was going to be played out in like four. Actually, the whole process, the first call for a master plan.
Yes.
I think was that in 2014. I think.
I don't know.
It was
right
March of 2014.
I think it was a little bit early then because it really came out of C2 because C2 was going to end all things, dogs and cats living together, kind of apocalypse, crush hour, you might remember that famous flyer. And then Dennis Carlone sort of ran his campaign on the idea that
which was 2013.
Right.
That's why I say it was when he took office in 2014. And he and two others, I forget who they were now, but they there were three councillors who said, we want to have a master plan and we want it to be run by the ordinance committee of the city council, which happened to be chaired by Dennis Carlone, I think.
Coincidence.
And Dennis Benzen as well, but somebody else, right? Mm-hmm. And then there were three other councillors who had a counter proposal that, well, okay, fine, but let's do it within the community development department. Yeah. And the compromise was to have a outside consultant, which turned out to be Util, sort of be the experts in the room.
But isn't that a weird result? Because what you're effectively saying is, like, your city planning department that you have somehow is not capable or cannot be trusted to engage in this large planning process, which to me, I would take offense from that right off the gun. And I just don't know, I understand why the compromise was made, But the hiring of consultants to sort of show us what the path is has never really yielded a really good result in Cambridge. And I think that that in part has to do with the fact that CDD, who is more intimately in tune with the neighborhoods, are really the best group to do that outreach.
You know, this is a little unrelated, but I'll say this, because, you know, when you know, I talked to a lot of people at Public Works over the years, including people in the sewerage division, and they would speak, and actually I've been down in the archives just to see these magnificent plans. If you actually look at the craftsmanship that was actually done in building sewers.
And these are the sewer maps you told me I wanted to have printed.
You really would, actually. But the thing is that we used to have in-house, mm-hmm. as sort of part of, right as part of city staff, people who were just craftsmen, who actually did things that were really magnificent. Mm-hmm. The modern day is that, oh, no, you would never have that in-house. You would just contract out and bring in such and such a company to do that. And I guess I can understand some of the economics of that. But there's something very appealing to me about actually having the people on staff who are just expert.
Right.
And who not only are expert, but also sensitive and smart enough to sort of that people can, they'll actually can build trust with right. amongst people, as opposed to just saying, I'm the smartest guy in the room. Do this because I know best, right?
And I think that's what we see a lot of.
We do.
Remember when we were in C2, there was a couple of consultants who were brought in for retail, and like, I think he he combined yuppie and hipster and said, yipsters are coming to Central Square. Right. And like five people in the audience just had heart attacks and died.
These retail consultants classify people.
Right. And, you know, that's because that's the world they live in.
Yeah.
The problem is it lacks the intimacy and sort of fine tuning that's required to engage the population on anything that is a sort of a larger change, which C2 was, and you almost instantly create problems for yourself.
Yeah.
And you always, whether inadvertently or inadvertently, polarize. And that's, that's where Envision is now.
Yeah.
And Envision, after 3 years of pretty much being quiet, is now this largely controversial thing because of three things that had really nothing to do with Envision.
Yeah, so I think they misstepped there. But you know, the one thing back in 2014 when they first proposed the master plan, mm-hmm. And then it turned into what they called community conversations. Then they hired Util, or maybe they were doing it simultaneously, and then they appointed the various committees that I was on. And you know, and then it's like a 3-year process. But at the very beginning, I had a kind of I probably said it in pretty public ways that what I thought would happen is people who would be put on these various committees, working committees, even if they were opposed to certain things, might actually become a little educated about some mm-hmm. things. So that if they were just opposed to constructing in, let's say, some of the major squares mm-hmm. or along the corridors, they might actually become convinced that maybe a little densification in some places, if done right, might actually be a good thing. And then the net product of the whole process would be that the Envision Cambridge would say that, you know, maybe we could benefit from a little density here, a little density there, whatever. And then the people who are the activist community who originally pushed to get this whole started would be then horrified.
Yeah.
Right, and they would disown it, and they would say, "What a horrible, horrible thing! This is a total failure." So I expected that
right.
from the beginning, because I just think that's almost inevitable.
Yeah,
like actually, with Central Square Committee you were on several years ago, you know. So I think everybody did good work, and they came back and they said, "Well, you know, having some buildings of a certain scale here, especially that was the first I heard of the idea of exempting ground floor from the."
Sure.
Floor area ratio, mm-hmm. so right. that you can build a little bit bigger building, but right. this way we could guarantee retail. But mm-hmm. nobody seemed to have solved the problem of how do you make that retail necessarily affordable to some of the people you want.
Because that's not the job of zoning.
I know. So
the city gets way too into trying to control market forces, and what they always wind up doing, whether it be residential or commercial, they just exacerbate
right.
the extremes.
So I always figured that the only way that was going to work to sort of get the affordable retail was basically with just some understandings.
Yeah.
And just talk to the property owners and just, you know, say, look, we give you a solid, you know, let's try and work together here.
Well, the commercial exemptions actually is some powerful magic in that you can replace the FAR somewhere else in the building, and only with certain size footprints of retail spaces. So the idea was that if you're a franchisee, you'll know, and this is, or you're a triple net national chain, typically you need a 2,000 square foot or greater footprint for corporate offices to even approve your space. So the idea is you keep it well below that, And then you're already in a different marketplace altogether. But the value is in taking it upstairs. So like you still let the market do its thing. But right now, the product that you're offering is simply not a product that the commercial market would like.
Right. So, you know, we have a big building going up.
Yes.
Here in the
It doesn't look that big to me, sir. It
really doesn't, honestly. So Mass and Main will eventually get padded out, and all the fenestration, I love these words.
Fenestration.
Will happen. And part of the promise of that is that in addition to just the Massachusetts Avenue frontage, there'll be sort of like a pass-through with some retail on that. Columbia Street becomes an active retail corridor.
Well, between my building, which we're wrapping around on Columbia Street on one side, and then the even side and Massaman on the odd side, we're going to have a nice corridor going down to Bishop Allen of commercial uses.
Double-loaded retail, basically, is what they love to
say. And those will be more affordable because they're not on the main thoroughfare.
That's been a point I've been pushing for 20 years, is say let's look at side streets as sort of opportunities. Because you don't necessarily need to have the, just let me just jokingly say, the baseball card shop doesn't have to be on Mass Ave frontage.
It can't be.
Right, it won't work. But the thing is, if you can have some opportunities sort of tucked around the edges.
I have people calling on a daily basis looking for space, so it's not through lack of demand. It's just simply the cost, the size, location. And these side streets, you've been talking about for 20 years, but planning in Cambridge has been talking about it for just as long, if not longer, but they failed to act on it.
Right. I mean, I still, in a sort of snarky way on my Civic Journal website, I still have, and I leave permanently at the bottom of the page, the never-ending list of Central Square studies.
I tell you, for all you budding petition writers, Cambridge is the greatest. They have they do all the work for you. They have data like you wouldn't believe. Write a petition, steal it from CDD, you're good to go.
You know, one of the things that always entertains me, though, is when you're looking at some study from the 1980s or the 90s or the aughts or today, whatever, how oftentimes it's the same themes keep coming back about what people want or need.
It's almost like all these, like you used to talk about the goals, and I didn't roll my eyes, but, you know, it's the same thing from every single report. We want more housing, more affordable housing, we want open space, we want trees, we want, you know, sunshine, and we want a little bit of wind on Monday, but not so much on Tuesday, that kind of stuff. And that's like, the master plan was a little bit of a red herring in terms of like, a master plan is like the coloring book. You're setting out your goals, this is what we like, this is what we don't like. It's the zoning that actually makes any of that real. Mm-hmm. And just like with C2 and Envision, like, that just belly flop. I think I was a little bit snarky with the Utah people when I first met them, because I just had the first draft of Central Square, and I was like, listen, I'm going to try to get this through. If you guys want to talk, they don't want to talk to me. But I said, I'll save you guys a lot of trouble in Envision. Don't look at the neighborhoods. Don't even look at them. Don't even think about Res A or Res B or any of that stuff. Look at the BA zones and the BB zones. That's the corridor up Mass Ave, through Porter Square.
Really,
the
where the focus was?
The business districts and the neighborhood business districts, which are completely underdeveloped and underutilized.
Right.
And call it a day. You'll save yourself. You know, you made $3.3 million. Kudos to you. You got some free advice. It was worth at least $1.5 million.
Yeah.
And you would have saved yourself a lot of time, a lot of frustration, because now what they're saying is this, with these overlays, that we're going to go into these extremely expensive areas, build a few units here, maybe or maybe not, depending on if there's funding, where the cost of development is always going to be cheaper in the BABB.
Right.
The zoning constraints are already almost completely non-existent in these areas. So it's just baffling to me that this is where we are.
Yeah. The one last thing I'll say on that, because I want to talk about something else, is that, you know, the notion about retail 5 years from now, 10 years from now. I mean, it's interesting with Amazon coming in here. I said, what is retail going to be? I think people still want to have it. And I
am sorry, but sometimes I feel like I look around the room and I see you, I see me, and I see a bunch of other old people. And I'm like, we're talking to the wrong people.
Right.
Like the decisions we're making now are going to affect people 10, 20 years from now. I don't see anyone in this room who will be using those things 10 years from now.
Actually, well, I did something today, interesting, because I teach at MIT. So they had a discussion about broadband access, and the ending of the broadband task force was Louis DePasquale officially ended it. But
sorry, Saul.
But simultaneously spawned this whole digital equity study thing that's going to happen in the future, right? You know, and I sort of wonder to myself sometimes. I said, well, how do people, real people who are coming of age now, access the internet? So in other words, are we people who are like, oh, I got to go check the, turn the VCR on, get that cable TV going here.
Or my desktop. Right. Which my assistant who's 20 is like, what is a desktop?
Right. So exactly. So when I, you know, when I talk to my students, you know, and they say, well, you know, can you help us with problem seven on the problem set? And what they do is they pull out their phone and they ask problem seven on their phone. And I thought to myself, you know, if you're one of, I mean, maybe really, for all I know, maybe everybody's accessing the internet via their phone, in which case, what does broadband do for them? Now, obviously, there are some reasons why that's not as simple as that.
Sure.
But, you know, honestly, I think there's a lot of value in just talking to the future consumers.
I'm not, this is not my area of expertise, but don't you think it's similar to transportation where people are, like, things are moving so quickly that people
Horse and buggy.
Well, people are reluctant to say this is the solution or that's the solution because new things come up all the time. I feel like the broadband, it's like the equivalent of me running Cat 5e through my house and then, you know, Cat 7 comes out and you're like, maybe I should have done that.
Yeah, actually, Craig Kelly actually is like the one person who seems at least a little ahead of this game here. Maybe some of the other counselors are coming on board in terms of transportation, because in recent years, a lot of controversy about bike lanes and flexi posts and all that junk. But the thing is, as Craig keeps pointing out, he said, you know, in a few years, you're not going to see necessarily people pedaling their way. They'll be using scooters or this type of device or whatever. Maybe, so the whole notion about what you need to accommodate or engineer around for safety purposes may not be what you think it is.
Leland Chung, the futurist.
Remember him and his hoverboard?
I thought it was ridiculous, but maybe he was telling the future for us.
Right. So again, in whether it's transportation or retail, I think maybe we ought to kind of watch and learn a little bit.
I also don't see it as like a sky is falling kind of problem. No. Like it's not certainly on the hierarchy of things we need to do. Like I would say that you could probably wait a little bit.
So another thing that popped up at the city council meeting 2 weeks ago, or is it last week? I forget now. And was made subject to the charter right and then came back at last night's meeting had to do with the First Street garage. Now, which is an issue that is separate from, but obviously interrelated with the Sullivan Courthouse issue. Right. And that was a big, big thing for, you know, that also goes back to like 2013 or 14.
Yeah. I mean, a big shout out to all the residents who fought that, took it to court and then codified a law that made every municipal building built under the immunity now a legal standing building in every municipality in the state.
Nice going. Yeah. So anyway, so the court proceedings, the final round of appeals went through. The Leggett McCall, who was the chosen developer, who was get rights to the building from the state. So they want to start to move forward. Now, part of the understanding, like 3 or 4 years ago, was, well, when that day finally happens, after all the legal challenges, is they had an understanding about using some of the First Street garage parking as a leasehold arrangement for pretty long term.
Which, as I understand, was a prior use of the courthouse that was there, yeah?
Right. See, that's the thing that makes it kind of curious, is that, so the, and actually I learned something last night I didn't know, because Dennis Carlone, City Councilor Dennis Carlone, was largely the principal author of the Cambridge Riverfront Plan.
Okay.
When they were actually building the gallery and mall and do that, you can, I have the it's actually one of the situations where if you look at the sketches of what people were envisioning to be built, and you go down there today, that's what you see. Ah. It really is what you see.
So Dennis Carlone is responsible for the Galleria Mall and the First Street Corridor.
Well, I mean, he didn't fund it, but he was working as the consultant working with the city in making that happen. Amazing. In sketching out a lot of those plans.
Amazing work.
Right. Now, the thing is that he pointed out that the First Street Garage, I think he said this last night, he said, I don't know that the city spent a dime on that.
Right?
Because the thing is that there were UDAG grants and other, you know, funds from other sources to build this garage, which was meant at least in part to support the courthouse use, both for employees, jurors, you know, people who came to do the court, and by having that garage, it meant they weren't going to be spilling over into the neighborhood, So in that sense, it was a benefit
I know I give Dennis a hard time, and I will continue to always. But, you know, it's nice to have some institutional memory for how these things get done, because they get really kind of taken out of hand a lot of the times at City Council, especially when contentious issues pop up, and you're like, well, wait a second, that's not actually how it happened.
That's right. You know, and it's nice to have somebody who actually remembers. Yeah. But, you know, there was a very controversial public meeting held kind of on the quick notice a week, I guess a week or so ago, about you know, what the neighborhood's feeling was. And, sure. and apparently one side, you know, came out in force and pretty clearly were in opposition to the city leasing the spaces. Mm-hmm. But I think it's fair to say it's because they're opposed to the redevelopment of the courthouse.
Yes.
And that, even though that's settled,
right.
in theory...
Not in theory. It's, I mean, that building stands. There's nothing taking that building down.
Right. Okay, so they say, okay, fine, you won in court, so now we're going to try and block you in the garage.
What's being sold now...
At least that's my read of it.
What's being sold now, which I think is really just irresponsible, is this notion that somehow a state representative is going to swoop in and... deliver the building back to Cambridge
you're,
some
you're
way.
Speaking of the opportunistic representative from
I'm talking about
Middlesex.
New yes. Money Mike. And
not my favorite elected official.
Well, you know, I mean, I like him well enough. I see him at Ribfest, I'll say hi. But like this particular issue, I think, is just being held. I mean, where was he last night? You know, where was, well, if he's leading the charge on that.
Not to get too political, though it is election day, but not locally, right?
I get people have responsibilities.
But you know, when Volpe was happening, or when there was a graduate student petition to sort of force housing on that, you know, to be tied to, as part of zoning, to mm-hmm. MIT's development of Volpe, you know, I think it's kind of bad form for a representative basically just sort of swoop in and opportunistically try and take advantage of some of these
controversies. But the irresponsible part of it is it gives people who don't really know this stuff well this sort of false
yes.
impression that, one, every one of the people on the city council is on the take.
Right.
Everybody at the city hall is somehow in on something, and that this crusader is the only person who could possibly make this bad thing right without any backup information or any support or any real plan.
Yeah.
And for a 500,000 square foot building that needs to be completely abated from the asbestos that's inside it, as a resident of Cambridge and as a citizen of the Commonwealth, I would protest the Cambridge taking this building on. The same way if I lived in Orange, Massachusetts, that I'd protest the Commonwealth giving this to the city of Cambridge for a dollar.
Right.
It's this, the Commonwealth has a responsibility to get fair market value. The building is a lawful building, and it's going to be reused.
Yeah,
and I think Leggett McCall has taken the challenge of doing this, where a lot of risk is on the line. And if we're talking about a few parking spaces, that's I see that as not as smokescreen for the larger issue.
Right.
And that was what was at the council last night, as far as putting a policy to study the parking for the courthouse in relation to a non-proposal that doesn't even really exist yet for the Galleria Mall.
Yeah, one of the things that was pointed out by several city councilors, I think, was that yes, there's one faction who just were going to just, you know, stop everything, period. But there were a lot of other people who were actually a little intimidated to even come to the meeting because they get harassed, who are actually, what bothers them more than anything is having this gigantic monolithic building just sitting there unused, just sort of this horrible eyesore. So they just want it. They wanted things to move along.
There was no one who got up and said, oh my God, the courthouse is beautiful. We should preserve it for all days. But I was actually surprised some people did show up and said,
several people actually
please move on.
Let's move along. Yeah. But anyway, it'll be interesting, I think, as it's clearly being made politically.
It's been political forever.
Yeah. One thing that actually, and again, not to jump to the other side of the issue here, is that there is some discussion here about the gallery, East Cambridgeside Galleria Mall, being a bit re-envisioned, not to bring up that envision word too much here, but you know, the Sears Roebuck is, or is it just Sears? The Roebuck's long gone, right? But the Sears stores around the country, they've been closing, and the word has it that Sears store will close.
I don't see why it wouldn't. I used to use it back in the day for some laundry machines, but there's many other places I can go to now.
Yeah,
But malls in general are reinventing themselves because retail use is reinventing itself. Yeah. So it's coming. Yeah. It just makes sense that you'd put housing there or make it a mixed-use development.
Yeah,
or,
there's a lot of old malls and things that are usually more suburban that are being re-envisioned by incorporating them with housing,
and they're
especially if they're close to transit.
They're great remodels because to build these big commercial structures, the infrastructure for them is perfect for a retrofit to residential.
Yeah.
You have all these big plumbing. All the underground stuff is done for you. And it's just, now it's no longer a bunch of stores.
Right. So it may well happen that part of that Galleria Mall could get re-envisioned.
Do you go to Galleria with any frequency?
Very rarely.
Yes.
Very rarely.
Along with the rest of the planet.
And the thing is, a lot of these sort of big boxy anchor stores are kind of more space than they are retail.
Yeah.
It's just like gigantic ceilings and huge space between... I mean, to me, a store is like where you have to fight your way through because there's so much stuff piled on, right?
It doesn't really exist in the same way anymore. It's largely service-based, and the big boxes that remain, like, I remember when, I think it was Restoration Hardware who took over Louis Boston's big building.
Yeah.
They don't sell things there. It's there as primarily a place to go, oh, I like that. I'll go order it online.
So anyway, the reason I mention it here is that if that gets re-envisioned and changed in any substantial way, the backup plan for Leggett McCall, should there be a political problem with the First Street Garage, was they said, well, we can always lease some of them from the Galleria.
Right.
So if some of that parking goes away, because that's sometimes what happens as part of these redevelopments, then the backup plan goes away in part two. So that kind of complicates things. You know, I think we'll still find, hopefully in the near term, a good resolution, because it would be great to just make things better there.
Yeah, but it might just be a bitter pill for some of the swallow. But I know compromise is a, you know, for some reason a terrible word in politics. But you know, the deal that's on the table isn't a bad one. It could be made better. But I don't see anyone trying to make the deal better. I see them just simply saying no.
I think that sometimes, and I'll just make the evil sweeping statement here as we close out the show, is that sometimes activism is there for the best, and sometimes it's there out of ego.
Yeah,
and it's just all about I'm going to win. And it's not necessarily about getting a solution.
I think even by and large, there's good people who just lose sight of why they're there.
Yeah. Anyway, see you next week.
Bye.